continuum. Consider just two examples. For the 18th century British philosopher David Hume, morality consists of just two parts: natural morality, which includes benevolence to those close to us, and artificial justice, which, when it is achieved, is unintentionally produced by human actions. For Hume, justice considered three artificial extensions of the natural person, namely relations to things, other persons, and events, property, promises, and contracts. This thoroughgoing individualist approach to justice makes it a derivative concern or an unintended byproduct rather than a natural principle. Adam Smith tied his theory of morality to how an impartial spectator would respond. The moral life of the species can be seen as the search for common standpoints from which the propriety or suitability of actions to their situations can be judged. Over time, certain regularities can be discerned in this search, and these are commonly specified in terms of the qualities of character that lie behind them, that is, in terms of the virtues, including justice. Not surprisingly, this rather unusual view of morality is similar to Adam Smith's idea of the invisible hand of capitalism, which transforms the selfish actions of the capitalists into the greatest possible benefit for society as a whole. In discussing human rights above, we noted that it's hard to avoid the conclusion that the libertarian position is self-serving. Those who have the most wealth somehow discover that the only human right that matters is the right to their own property, and when it comes to acquiring possessions, the right to freedom from outside interference. The early modern European position on justice is similar. It maintains that the only kind of justice the state should uphold is the justice of strict equality. The wealthy should not be taxed at a higher rate than the poor, and they should receive equal distributions of government support. The rich work hard. Hence, they are entitled to whatever profits come their way. If the poor person does not earn enough to support his family, it must be because he is lazy. On this view, systemic injustices are excluded from consideration. Because libertarians assume that capitalist economics establishes a level playing field, they want to conclude that wealth is evidence of hard work and strong character, whereas poverty implies laziness and lack of character. The kinds of injustice that arise from factors outside the control of the individual worker, disadvantages that come from one's class, gender, skin color, educational opportunities, or access to capital, are generally excluded from consideration under the libertarian theory of justice. How then can we move toward a more pluralistic concept of justice, one that takes into account the full range of factors that are relevant to evaluating just and unjust acts? Sheer numerical equality is simply not complex enough to capture all the factors relevant to just decision-making. We need to strive for a far more systemic and long-term point of view. It does not suffice to consider only the given, the status quo. We need an imaginative, ethically sensitive exploration of how society could be restructured today. Amartya Sen does not go far enough, but his discussion of justice does offer a starting point. In The Idea of Justice, he notes that it is central to the idea of justice that we can have a strong sense of injustice on many different grounds, and yet not agree on one particular ground as being the dominant reason for the diagnosis of injustice. Injustices are multifactorial. There's rarely just one failure of justice at work. Moreover, justice includes considerations of myriad social relations and processes. It depends on how an action is realized in social relationships. The outcomes, Sen notes, cannot be captured by any simple account of objective duties. An appropriate understanding of social realization, central to justice as nyaya, has to take the comprehensive form of a process-inclusive broad account. It would be hard to dismiss the perspective of social realizations on the grounds that it is narrowly consequentialist and ignores the reasoning underlying deontological concerns. A theory of justice that lives up to these requirements must include at least three major features. 1. One needs to avoid any arbitrary reduction of multiple and potentially conflicting principles to one solitary survivor, guillotining all the other evaluative criteria. Narrowing the field, as libertarians do, is not, in fact, a prerequisite for getting useful and robust conclusions on what should be done. This implies the need for a pluralist approach. Rather than limiting one's attention to a single notion of distributive justice, one needs a multifaceted theory of justice that encompasses the whole continuum. 2. One can achieve a sufficiently broad and multifaceted picture only if one begins with the analysis of injustices and derives one's theory of justice from there. It takes both intellectual work and intuitive practice to deepen awareness of the whole range of injustices. Cultural, economic, social, and historical research is required, as well as philosophical analysis. 3. In particular, justice has to do with how different communities interact. An individual may be treated unjustly, but usually the full analysis of the situation includes patterns of mistreatment. In most countries, these patterns calcify into inequalities between the classes. Rectifying injustices thus requires readjusting the relations between the communities involved, whether by removing systemic oppression, increasing political representation, improving economic or educational opportunities, or redistributing resources. A communitarian approach to injustices that employs these three features begins to make concrete what is implied by the ideal of justice. Marx may have been suspicious of the term justice because it is often used by the wealthy to justify their behaviors and policies, but he has powerfully expressed what a just system would look like. In a higher phase of communist society, after the enslaving subordination of the individual to the division of labor, and therewith also the antithesis between mental and physical labor, has vanished, after labor has become not only a means of life, but life's prime want, after the productive forces have also increased with the all-around development of the individual, and all the springs of cooperative wealth flow more abundantly, only then can the narrow horizon of bourgeois right be crossed in its entirety, and society inscribe on its banners, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. The ideal of justice that we are uncovering here will look to Marx's outcome as its goal, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. At the same time, a postmodern, organic Marxism will recognize that injustices are complex and multifaceted, that cultures and ecologies are intertwined non-deterministic systems where small changes have unpredictable outcomes, and that interventions therefore call for careful study and great sensitivity. Marx's determinism is left behind, and his belief that utopia is imminent is set aside. Nonetheless, the ideal of justice Marx formulated remains as powerful as ever. The Marxian goal, translated into constructive postmodern terms, is described by the political theorist Franklin Gamwell. Gamwell draws from the resources of Whitehead's process philosophy. An actuality realizes greater good because it realizes greater creativity, and the greater good of all realizations together is the greater realization of unity in diversity. With Whitehead, we can say that concrete good is defined aesthetically. In this sense, injustices represent imbalances, disharmonies, between subsystems, and only from the perspective of the whole can justice emerge. Justice seeks the dialectical goal of a harmonious unity in diversity. In the end, justice is about the redistribution of power. Power interests are deeply ingrained, and those with power rarely give up their privileges voluntarily. If it were not for the clouds of global crisis that are already forming on the horizon, we would have to conclude that change is unlikely. But the planetary changes that humans have wrought on this planet are coming, The only question is whether they will produce increased brutality and viciousness, or a more enlightened civilization after the fall of the present one. It behooves us to formulate visions of a more harmonious and just society, in the hope that the next chapter will be an improvement over the one that is now coming to an end. Conclusion. The period of human civilization, known as modernism, has brought more change than any other era in human history. Unfortunately, this particular era also narrowed its horizon, identifying the universal human goals, freedom, justice, democracy, human rights, with a narrowly capitalist and individualistic worldview. Later modern movements, Marxism, socialism, European and Russian communism, sought to correct this mistake. But in the context of the modernist competition, they became enmeshed with the same limitations of either-or thinking that had infected their opponents. Only with the advent of the postmodern era has it become possible to begin speaking of these four ideals again without the dominance of capitalist principles and either-or thinking. The so-called First Enlightenment in early modern Europe may have intertwined freedom, human rights, democracy, and justice with capitalist assumptions, but a second Enlightenment is now underway, one that seeks to purify these basic human aspirations from the mistakes of the modern era. Organic Marxism seeks to honor the higher ideals of one of the great European reformers, Karl Marx, while transplanting his program of reform into the context of a postmodern ecological world. As the starting point for this postmodern rethinking, we have advocated the process economics of Cobb and Daly's For the Common Good. Cobb and Daly focus on an earth-centered global order, understood as a community of communities. They acknowledge that, under modern assumptions, individuals gain their rights to personal happiness and wealth within the context of their particular nation-state. Nations compete against other nations just as individuals compete for limited wealth against other individuals. And just as individuals ask for the freedom not to be interfered with, so nations have also turned to the United Nations or to the armies of the most powerful nations for protection of their sovereignty against aggressors. Like Franklin Gamwell, Cobb and Daly envision an era when the competition between individuals and between nations does not get the last word. They share the central ideal of an organic Marxism, an ecological world order understood as a community of communities that is relational all the way down. In such a world, every world citizen is accountable to the communities of others as he or she is also accountable to a particular home community. And all of us are, together, accountable to the global community of life, without which we cannot survive. Part 3. Organic Marxism. Chapter 9. Marxism and the Ecological Sciences, the Science of Organic Systems. Organic and Contextualized Knowledge. Over the course of this study, we have repeatedly observed the diverse ways that Marxism has been embodied and embedded in particular historical and cultural contexts. Marx may have originally presented his analysis as a timeless apprehension of the dialectic of human history and the class struggle, and many of his insights do still speak powerfully to our time. Today, however, we see even more clearly that the dynamics of socialism and capitalism, of wealth and poverty, always come woven into a particular time, place, and society. The scalpel in the hand of a great surgeon brings health and saves lives. The same scalpel in the hands of a violent person can bring death. Previous chapters have revealed how differently Marxism is understood in the context of modernist thought and of constructive or deconstructive postmodernism. Building on those results, we now explore the development of Marxism in the context of organic thinking. Knowledge is organic when it grows in a system constituted by living interconnected relationships, both among its parts and with its surrounding environment. What constitutes an environment, in this sense, depends on what kind of entity one is talking about. The environment for a cell consists of the cells surrounding it and the medium in which it lives, earth, water, or air. The environment for an organism consists of the other organisms with which it interacts and the non-living characteristics of its ecological niche, temperature, mineral resources, food sources, and toxins. The environment for a person consists of other persons, both present and past, and the social values and conventions that they embody, together with the environmental features already named. Finally, the environment for a state or society encompasses all of these factors, as well as its unique history, culture, language, beliefs, geography, and aspirations for the future. These observations might seem obvious, except for the fact that they are so frequently ignored or overlooked. Philosophers create theories based on their experience of a particular country, culture, and age, and they write for that context. Frequently, the theories are then transported to completely different countries and cultures, presupposing that the features of the original context will still apply at the new destination. Experience shows that this assumption is often false. There is a second reason why the organic nature of all living philosophies, Marxism included, is so frequently overlooked. It is this. When the modern European philosophers encountered the claim that philosophies are not simply universal, but are organically connected to a particular culture, they tended to equate that view with relativism. Many of them claimed that if theories are not objective and universal, if they do not apply to all people at all times, then they must be purely subjective. But in that case, they warned, humans will have no criteria for deciding between political and ethical systems. One will have no way of knowing which statements are true and which are false, which actions are good and which are evil. Complete chaos will result, because now anything goes. This kind of either-or thinking was widespread in Europe in the modern period. Among its harmful effects was the alleged forced choice between knowledge is objective and universal on the one side, and all is relative on the other. Tertium non datur, they said. There is no third alternative, no middle way. Numerous Marxist authors in the postmodern West have sought to undercut this false dichotomy. In his classic early work, Knowledge and Human Interests, the great philosopher of the Frankfurt School, Jürgen Habermas, showed that human interests affect all knowledge claims. The idea of purely objective knowledge is a myth. There is an organic relationship between what we know and the needs and interests that we bring. Richard Bernstein's Beyond Objectivism and Relativism likewise made a comprehensive case that the vast majority of human claims to knowledge fall in the space between sheer relativism and objectively justified claims. These early opponents of modernism relied on primarily negative arguments in order to weaken the hold of centuries of old prejudice. Because their work was successful, we are now in a position to develop a positive account. Fortunately, during the same years, the sciences of life have been developing as well. The paradigm for much of modern science was reductionism. As Steven Weinberg famously wrote, "All explanatory arrows point downward. Living systems must ultimately be explained in terms of the laws of pre-living systems, such as chemistry and physics." The rapid growth of systems biology is helping to change that paradigm, however. Today, when scientists study a particular system, say the system of all protein interactions in an E. coli bacterium, they study both the lower-level systems that influence protein interactions and the higher-order systems that constrain their behaviors as well. The arrows of explanation, it turns out, point both downward and upward. The best example of this more organic approach to the study of living systems is one that emerges out of the environmental sciences, the organic relationship between an organism and its ecosystem. For too long, biologists sought to explain interactions between organisms in purely mechanistic terms. Today, the organic model allows us to move beyond mechanism, as the title of an important recent book describes it. Just as the social sciences need to describe and explain the personal dimension of human existence, including the complex worlds of meaning that humans create and live within, so also the biological sciences can now describe organisms as organisms, that is, as agents acting within their particular ecosystems. The science of interconnected systems. A quick survey of a few of the contemporary sciences provides a good introduction to the details of the emerging organic worldview. If it were not for these developments in the natural sciences, the science of organisms would not be possible. Interconnection in the physical sciences. Physics and physical chemistry cannot directly teach about organic relationships, since they study the pre-organic physical world. However, several developments in physics over the last 120 years offer support for the organic model in the biological sciences. They also provide some helpful analogies to organic models in biology. It goes without saying that disanalogies also exist. The physical world turned out to be far more interconnected than scientists had thought before the 20th century. In Newtonian physics, one calculates the trajectories of independently existing physical objects in a rigid Cartesian space, with time as a separate type of dimension. It was Albert Einstein's theory of special relativity that first revealed the interconnection of space and time. His theory of general relativity then linked the geometry of space to the mass of objects. Extremely massive objects, such as black holes, actually bend space. Quantum physics, the physics of the very small, brought an even greater level of interconnectedness. The first surprise was the interconnectedness of the observer with the object observed. Many physics students learn about the collapse of the wave function, represented by the Schrödinger wave equation, through an experiment known as the double-slit experiment. In this experiment, a beam of light, which is divided and sent through two separate slits simultaneously, impacts a screen differently depending on whether or not the beam of light is measured as it passes through one of the two slits. If unmeasured before the screen, the light apparently passes through both slits, since when it hits the screen, it shows the kind of interference effects that one would expect from a wave. If measured at one slit, however, the interference effects disappear. The light now strikes the screen as individual photons of light. The act of observation apparently suffices to transform the light from waves to particles. According to the standard, or Copenhagen, interpretation of quantum mechanics, the act of observation or measurement brings about a collapse of the quantum probabilities into a specific state of affairs. Before observation, many scientists said, the subatomic state existed merely as a potential to be observed. Thus, in Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker's famous thought experiment, a single electron inside a vacuum-sealed box would be described mathematically as being in all parts of the box simultaneously, based on its probability distribution. If a divider is then placed in the middle of the box, and the physicist measures, he will find the electron either 100% present or 0% present on one side of the box. If a divider is then placed in the middle of the box, and the physicist measures, he will find the electron either 100% present or 0% present on one side of the box, as one would expect from a particle. The connection between the observer and what is observed has had some rather radical implications. For example, it would mean that a photon of light traveling for 300 million light years from a distant star remained a mere potential to be observed until the moment you perceive it, at which point it is retroactively resolved into a particular photon of light, which we now say retrospectively, has been traveling through space for those hundreds of millions of years. Following the logic of this supposition, the famous Princeton physicist John Wheeler suggested that the universe as a whole might have existed in a sort of potential state until agents evolved who could observe it, at which point it became actual for the first time. The discovery of entangled particles by Alain Aspect in 1982 offered yet another dramatic example of universal interconnection. Aspect's experiments have since been replicated at distances above 300 kilometers. The experiment involves two prepared particles issuing from a single source and traveling in opposite directions. The physics says that their spin is indeterminate until the moment of measurement. If one measures just one of the particles at a particular instant and discovers it to be, for example, spin up, the other particle instantly resolves into its complement, in this case, spin down. Because there is not time for a message to travel between the particles, even at the speed of light, no information could have passed from one to the other. Most physicists conclude that the two particles constitute a single physical system, even when separated by 300 kilometers or more. Given that entangled particles emerge in very many different places in the universe, we must now conclude that the universe manifests profound interconnections across vast distances. Again, these are not yet organic, but they lay the foundation for organic interconnections at the level of life. The scientific description of interconnections at the microphysical level is further deepened in quantum field theory. The equations of quantum field theory presuppose that these fields are physically more foundational than particles. The quantum field manifests itself as particles under certain conditions and at certain times. Particles arise out of the field as a sort of distillate. It would be false to say that only fields exist. After all, the physical world is described by both discrete and continuous functions. Still, it's clear that the interconnectedness at the microphysical level, waves, fields, plasma clouds, etc., is far greater than classical physics ever imagined. Systems biology. In 1953, Crick and Watson discovered the double helix structure of DNA, which transmits genetic information from parent to offspring. Not surprisingly, in the few decades that followed, the primary focus fell on these newly discovered biochemical units that are involved in cell reproduction, DNA molecules and their chemical structure, genes and chromosomes, amino acids and proteins, the biochemistry of cells, and intercellular communication. Unfortunately, environmental factors received less attention during those years. In the first excitement about the genetic breakthroughs, scientists tended to overstate their ability to explain most biological phenomena in genetic terms, cell functioning, disease, macroevolution, even psychological characteristics such as intelligence. In recent years, however, scientific attention has turned to the study of more systemic influences. Both epigenetics and systems biology focus on interactions between genetic information and environmental factors. Systems biology studies individual cells, or groups of cells, viewing them as systems. Because of the rapid growth of microbiology, systems biologists are now able to explain how cells function in terms of specific subsystems within a single cell, such as the system of all proteins, proteomics, or the system of all metabolites, metabolomics. Predictions of broader developments within the body, such as the probability of suffering from breast cancer, are far more accurate when systems of proteins are considered, rather than just individual genes. Indeed, biologists now recognize that groups of genes switching on and off in a coordinated fashion, rather than individual genes, are responsible for most of the body's developmental processes. Beyond mechanism, the new science of organisms. A growing movement within the biological sciences has challenged the mechanistic and reductionist assumptions that ruled biology since the advent of neo-Darwinism, the new synthesis of Darwin and genetics in the 1930s and 1940s. In the past, those who defended explanations at the level of organisms were considered to be anti-naturalist and anti-imperialist. The reductionist methods of science, it was said, require that living organisms be explained primarily at the biochemical, chemical, and physical levels. Explanations given in terms of organisms were said to be holistic, in a negative sense. Talk of organisms as beings with perceptions and purposes was considered to be too vague to be scientific. The reductionists challenged whether one could ever provide rigorous scientific analysis and testing of organism-based theories. But advances in the biological sciences have changed the situation dramatically. We are now able to provide testable accounts of how unicellular organisms perceive their environments through chemical osmosis. We can study the evolution of the first nerve cells and the formation of rudimentary nervous systems. We can identify specific structures that perform specific organismic functions. Teleology, the study of structures and behaviors that enable organisms to carry out purposive actions, is no longer supernatural or God-inspired. It is now an accepted part of the scientific study of the natural world. Biologists recognize organisms as teleological in the harmless sense that the evolutionary process defines goals for all organisms. As theoretical biologist Stuart Kaufman recently described it in a conversation, each organism is out to earn a living in the world. When a microorganism swims up a glucose gradient toward a food source, or when it recoils from a toxin, Kaufman argued, it is acting teleologically, with purpose. These are examples of actions that it performs as an organism, engaging in organic relations with its surroundings. The organism as a unit is an emergent agent, constituted by sub-processes but not reducible to them. Ecosystems theory. In the late 20th century, biologists began putting together the conclusions that they had acquired through the new advances in genetics and microbiology. In recent years, this explosion of detailed knowledge has produced a far deeper understanding of how organisms interact with each other and with their environments. The new biology does not reduce organisms to the subsystems and chemical components of which they are composed. Rather, it draws on the knowledge of subsystems in order to produce more accurate descriptions of how organisms are able to function as agents in the world. We are as interested in telling the story of the emergence of structures as we are in breaking the emergent structures down into their component parts. As biologists began to turn their more detailed knowledge to the study of agents in interaction, the new ecological sciences were born. We now know that much of the biosphere consists of reciprocal organic relationships. Marxists might view this as a particular kind of dialectical materialism. The one-way deterministic relationships of the older biology, by contrast, only tells part of the story. So, for example, we have long understood how genes code for proteins and how proteins carry out programmed functions within the cell. More recently, biologists have learned how influences from outside the cell affect the timing of gene expression, even altering the order of bits of chemical information, transposons. Genetic and environmental information continually interact in both directions, with both influencing how organisms exercise their agency. Evolutionary developmental biology, EVO-DEVO, studies the complex mechanisms for intercellular communication. We now know that behaviors of individual cells are strongly influenced by systems of cells. Nobel Prize laureate Gerald Edelman describes the brain as a whole as an evolving interconnected system responding to its surrounding environment. The body of each organism can thus be conceived as a sort of ecosystem, with the body's subsystems, such as the immune system and the mechanisms that preserve homeostasis, linking its parts into an interconnected and self-regulating whole. Just as no one would analyze the economy of a village apart from its interactions with other towns and with the province, so also no one would study a subsystem of a body without including its relationships with other subsystems and with the body as a whole. Nor are environments merely static backdrops or containers, determining the fates of the organisms that live there. Of course, external events can impact an ecosystem from outside, as when a tsunami carries ocean water into a forest far inland from the ocean. More typically, however, an ecosystem is co-constituted by its member species. Biologists once treated each ecological niche as a pre-given environment, within which organisms had to fight for survival against their competitors, who are continually making and transforming their own niche, at the same time that they are adapting to the changes in climate, in resources, and in the behavior of other organisms. In sum, the new biology is about emergent organic relationships between living things and their environments, mediated through the subsystems of cells, organs, and subsystems. Instead of defining the process only in competitive terms, biologists today, such as Martin Nowak at the Harvard University Program for Evolutionary Dynamics, interpret it in a cooperative manner, as a kind of symbiosis, literally living together. The Contemporary Study of Consciousness. We close with a brief word on the neurosciences, where similar kinds of changes are also taking place. The brain determinists held that to reconstruct the electrochemical processes in the brain is to understand thought. No separate analysis of subjective experiences or mental influences is required. Ideas are merely epiphenomena, they argued. They arise from neuronal firings, but do not play any causative role. As one researcher from a University of California Medical Center told us, "Wires and chemicals, that's all we are. Wires and chemicals." By contrast, several decades ago, neuroscientists such as Roger Sperry, the Nobel laureate in medicine, began to challenge this unidirectional analysis of thought. According to Sperry, mind is an emergent property of the brain, one that reveals its own unique types of causal influence. Studying the interaction of brains with cultural systems, using a correlational model, has led to a richer understanding of how brains and mental awareness are related. One can learn about the neural correlates of consciousness without having to eliminate consciousness, ideas, and culture as natural realities in their own right. The school of embodied embedded cognition, for example, considers the brain in relation to the whole body, and both in relation to the surrounding environment, including thoughts, ideas, and culture. Far more knowledge of the mind-body relationship can be achieved when one studies them in a systemic, bidirectional manner than if one treats brains only as causes and ideas only as byproducts. Conclusion. In this chapter, we have explored just a few examples of developments in contemporary science. Physics and chemistry are not organic sciences, but they too are revealing types of interconnection that were inconceivable in the context of modern Newtonian science. But the physical sciences have played a role in the emergence of the new organic sciences. We considered systems biology, organism-centered approaches in biology, ecosystems theory, and the contemporary study of consciousness. These advances, taken together, shed important new light on what an organic approach means. When the insights of organicism are applied to social, political, and economic questions, organic Marxism is the result. As an important recent book describes it, one can now do biological science beyond mechanism by putting life back into biology. For much of the modern period, scientists were forced to choose between a non-scientific holism and a complete reduction of living beings to their physical and chemical components. This is similar to the choice between objectivism and relativism that characterized modern philosophy. Today, this is no longer a forced choice. thanks to advances in the life sciences and to a change of theoretical perspective, biologists can now study the biosphere organically, giving the agency of organisms a central role. Detailed knowledge about subsystems, drawn from biochemistry and microbiology, does not compete with organic biology. It contributes to the complete picture. Organic Marxism is grounded, in part, in this newly emerging understanding of organisms, ecosystems, and the Earth's biosphere as a whole. Like the new biology, it is organic and bidirectional, rather than deterministic and unidirectional. This is not a case of choosing one's science based on one's political beliefs. Russian Marxists once attempted that strategy, to the great detriment of both science and politics. Instead, it's a matter of recognizing an important paradigm change in the biological sciences and drawing out its implications for the study of human social systems. The recent developments have helped move scientists beyond the idea that only a strictly reductionist science could count as good biology. Unfortunately, political theorists have been slow to recognize the implications of this shift to an organic paradigm for traditional political theories, such as Marxism. The implications are revolutionary. Isn't it inconsistent to view the biosphere as built up out of living, evolving organic relationships, while maintaining that political and economic systems function in a mechanistic, deterministic fashion? Isn't it strange to say that brain and mind exist in dynamic interaction, while conceiving of culture and ideas as a mere superstructure that is carried along by socioeconomic forces as its real causes? Postmodern Marxists should let Marx's 19th century version of deterministic materialism wither away, replacing it with an updated organic model, so that the enduring insights of his work can continue to guide political theory today. The famous theoretical biologist Stuart Kaufman has recognized the promise that the new organic biology holds out for revisioning human societies in the 21st century. He writes, "The rather fixed world is not how real life is. We live a life of ever-unfolding, often unprestatable opportunities that we partially create and co-create, with and without intent. I am thus falling in love with living the well-discovered life. Then my own dream for beyond modernity starts to become our 30 civilizations around the globe, woven gently together to protect the roots of each, yet firmly enough to generate ever new cultural forms by which we can be human in increasingly diverse, creative ways, each helping himself or herself and the other to live a well-discovered life, and ameliorating our deep shadow side. We need an enlarged version of ourselves and of what we can become." Chapter 10. Organic Marxism, Process Philosophy, and Chinese Thought. Organic Marxism as an Open Marxism. In this chapter, we turn to the significant parallels between organic Marxism, process philosophy, and traditional Chinese thought. Establishing the interconnections between these three different traditions is a crucial step in developing any social philosophy that serves the common good, rather than the wishes of the few. Engaging in comparative discussions like this one is a central feature of a growing group of Marxist schools of thought. We here use the common label organic Marxism in order to draw attention to what these emerging schools share in common. Open Marxisms flourish in the constructive postmodern context, rejecting the rationalism and determinism that dominated the modern European period. They acknowledge that all of life is an open-ended process, and that leaders manage at the local, national, and international levels, always at the edge of chaos. Scientific thinking has moved from the study of closed systems to open, non-static, organic systems. Chapter 9. In response, Economic and political theories have likewise begun to shift from the old orthodox and doctrinaire schools of thought to much more fluid, dynamic, and responsive approaches. For scholars and leaders today who are interested in structuring society for the good of humanity and the planet, these new embedded and contextualized Marxisms are bringing new life to Marxist critiques of wealth and power in the West. The tendency for the wealthiest class to assume power and to utilize that power to its own advantage at the expense of the non-wealthy is pervasive across capitalist systems. It's why such systems exist in the first place. Yet the details of how the injustices are overcome and what society looks like afterwards are not uniform. Open Marxisms recognize how greatly cultures vary and how deeply cultural systems affect the way a given society is organized and experienced. These differences crop up even when analyzing such central Marxian themes as work, production, and class relations. What about the distinctive features of the Chinese context? Many scholars today, both in China and in the West, are working in the spirit of the new open Marxisms. We include among them the Return to Marx movement, which represents an important Marxist school in China today. This movement emphasizes the importance of turning back to the original Marx and reading his works, without being dominated by the interpretations of Lenin and the later Russian Marxists. The Return to Marx school offers an important corrective to a certain tendency in the early phase of Chinese Marxism, which sometimes lets Russian Marxists define the form that Marxism should take in China. At the same time, recent scholarship has also uncovered the dissimilarities between 19th century German Marxism and our present context. The differences invite one to update Marx and to engage in a constructive rethinking of Marxism. As Professor Wang Zhihe writes, "Unlike orthodox Marxism or dogmatic Marxism, Chinese Marxism is an open Marxism which changes form according to the current situation. From Mao Zedong's thought and Deng's theory to Jiang's Three Represents theory and Hu's scientific outlook on development, all point to such an open orientation." Numerous publications on constructive postmodernism in China have already shown how deeply process thought connects with the ancient philosophical traditions of China. In this respect, postmodern thought contrasts strongly with modernism, which usually defines itself in opposition to the traditions that precede it. Organic Marxism is a form of process thinking. Both affirm that reality is an open, evolving process. Each time categories of thought are planted in a new context, be it a new culture, historical period, region, or political movement, they sprout and grow in new ways. Consequently, open process thinkers do not expect Marxism to be a static thing, but to evolve continually, just as human social systems are constantly evolving. These are the reasons it is crucial to explore the connections between the three terms in the title to this chapter. Regarding the first relation, the links between traditional Chinese thought and process philosophy have long been recognized. Concerning the second, we have been attempting to show in these chapters how process philosophy helps to transform modernist Marxism into organic Marxism. It remains only to show, third, how Chinese traditional wisdom can play an important role in organic Marxism. For example, we have been disappointed to see that ecological Marxism rarely mentions the Chinese traditions. We hope that our constructive proposal will help to overcome that limitation. Marx and Whitehead. Alfred North Whitehead is as central to process thought as Marx is to socialism. We believe that Whitehead is important for organic Marxism in two ways. On the one hand, he helped to convince Western thinkers in the 20th century that process is central to both science and human experience, in the way that the I Ching convinced Chinese philosophers of the same conclusion. On the other hand, Whitehead's challenge to either-or thinking in politics helped to open the door for postmodern Marxism. Especially since the Second World War, many people in the West believe that every nation is either capitalist, which they believe is good, or communist, which they believe is bad. Either a country allows market forces to operate, which makes it libertarian and capitalist, or it bans markets in favor of state ownership, which makes it Marxist and communist. Worse, during the Cold War, people in the West argued that freedom, democracy, justice, and human rights are only present in capitalist countries. When one encounters a false dichotomy, the wisest thing to do is to challenge the claim that the two sides are incompatible. One should look instead for both-and solutions that are more adequate than either of the alternatives alone. This is the core of dialectical thinking, which was central to Hegel and Marx. It's ironic that Western critics identify dialectical thinkers like Hegel and Marx with only one side of a forced choice, since their central contention was that the dialectical advance of history will over time incorporate both sides of each opposition. It seems clear that there are times when market forces bring benefits within a nation and between nations, and there are other cases in which unrestrained markets produce injustices that neither local communities nor the global community should accept. A major contribution of organic Marxism lies in its ability to blend elements from both of these two socio-economic systems. We challenge the claim that democracy and socialism are inherently opposed to one another. Marx was right to view socialism as the most consistent form of democracy. Alfred North Whitehead clearly saw the advantages of this both-and approach. It begins to look as though the one thing democracy has that is worth saving is the freedom of the individual. But I would say, too, the freedom of the individual is one, but your knowledge of history will remind you that there has always been misery at the bottom of society. Our own age is the first time when there need be no material want. Russia has relieved the suffering of the masses at the price of the individual's liberty. The fascists have destroyed personal liberties without really alleviating the condition of the masses. The task of democracy is to relieve mass misery and yet preserve the freedom of the individual. Anne Fairchild Pomeroy has argued that Marx and Whitehead can supplement each other. As she writes, "Marx needs Whitehead to ground his claims regarding the proper ethos and telos of human life and its productive, processive interaction with, for, and as a part of the world as a relational unity. Whitehead needs Marx to focus on the destructive aspects of capitalism as a form of world productive process." It's surprising that one finds such resistance to this both-and solution. Instead of thinking in dialectical or Taoist fashion, nations have remained locked into one option or the other. Sadly, North Americans have been particularly resistant to blending in the resources of socially oriented thinking. Whitehead saw this clearly. "We English and Americans are singularly unimaginative in our interpretations of the term democracy. We seem unable to admit under any definition any form of society which does not conform closely to our own. I believe that the two great powers which will emerge from this war, World War II, will be Russia and America, and the principles which animate them will be antithetical. That of Russia will be cohesion, that of America will be individualism." Certainly the last decades have shown an increasing turn toward individualism among Americans, at exactly the time that global climate disruption calls for community-based thinking and integrated international action to reduce pollution levels, to which the United States is a major contributor, thereby taking steps toward becoming a more ecological civilization. Both Marx and Whitehead challenge individualism and encourage a more social thinking. What is process thought? One can identify four central features of process thinking. Each one has deep resonance with traditional Chinese philosophy. When combined, they provide the conceptual foundation for organic Marxism. 1. A relational view of reality. Every event is constituted by its relationships to other events. There is therefore no such thing as a discrete individual existing by itself. the features of one event affect all other events. Alfred North Whitehead expressed this insight by translating the Western language of things, or entities, into the language of events. Actual entities, he explained, are really events. He also spoke of them as actual occasions. Thus, as Whitehead wrote in his great work, Process and Reality, to function means to contribute determination to the actual entities in the nexus of some actual world. Thus, the determinant